Right, good evening, members, officers and members of the public, and welcome to this meeting of the Planning and Licensing Committee. First item on the agenda is Chairman's notices, so I'll just go through these briskly. Probably everyone's getting familiar with them now. Sound recording of meeting. Please note that the Council will be recording any part of this meeting held in open session for subsequent publication on the Council's website. And I'm making that announcement now. Members of the public attending the meeting with a view to speaking are deemed to be giving permission to be included in the recording. Fire, in the event of fire, follow the little green man out of the building, please, and assemble in the assembly point just outside the Council office's main entrance. Health and safety, can I draw your attention, please, to the altering levels in the Council chamber, denoted by, I think I call it the yellow and black tape, the bumblebee pattern. And just for everyone's safety and other reasons, this is, meeting is being closed circuit televisioned, so CCTV'd. Thank you very much. Can I have apologies for absence? I think I only have Councillor Pratt, and unfortunately no sub. Agenda item number 3, minutes of the last meeting. Now, I've got on my agenda pages 5 to 12, but actually on the paper form I've got pages 7 to... pages 7 to 13 included. So, members, what have you got on your machines?
Five.
You've got five, okay.
3, 5, 4.
Okay, I'll go 3, 5, 4 then. So, I wasn't at the last meeting, so for matters of accuracy only, please. Page 354, page 355, page 356, 357, 358, 359, 360. Are they agreed, members?
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed. We now move on to the... Oh, here we go. I've got my computers jammed. We now move on to agenda item number 6, which is the approval of the Malden District Heritage... Oh, sorry, have I missed that out? Beg your pardon. Oh, beg your pardon. Sorry, and the participation I have. Disclosure of... That's me flicking over. You know what's happened there? It's gone from here straight to there on my computer. Sorry about that. I'll keep to the paper copy. It might be safer. Disclosure of interest, agenda item number 4. Any disclosure of interest? Thank you, Councillor St. Joseph.
Non-pecuniary interest. I know that some of the owners of the in the Heritage of Risk Register.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other disclosures? I'll disclose a non-pecuniary interest as a member of Essex County Council, as there's various references in various items on the agenda to Essex County Council. Councillor Durham.
On that basis, Councillor Chairman, I will also declare a non-pecuniary interest as a member of Essex County Council.
Okay, thanks very much indeed. Agenda item number 5, public participation. There are none, I believe, so thank you. Now we'll get on to agenda item number 6. Approval of the Malden District Heritage at Risk Register 2018. And Mr. Howson is here with us tonight, so I will let him take us through the report. But this is about approval being sought from this committee for the publication of the Malden District Heritage at Risk Register 2018. So, Mr. Howson, if I could handle over to you for a short presentation, that would be great. Thank you.
Sure. I just pressed this button to change the slides. Right, okay. For many years, Essex County Council produced a Heritage at Risk Register for the whole of the county, but they stopped providing that service, so we established our own register in 2017. The register is simply an inventory of each of the historic buildings in the district, currently regarded as at risk of deterioration or loss. The primary aim of the register is to highlight the plight of these buildings to current owners and local communities and encourage immediate care and their future conservation. The number of buildings considered at risk remains the same as last year. That's 21 in total, in that one building can now be removed from the register and one building has been proposed for addition. However, this year has seen some significant progress towards removing several of the buildings from the register. And rather than talk about every building on the register, which I think would take too long, I'll just provide you with some of the highlights. First of all, 1 High Street, Malden, was added to the register for the first time in 2017 and can now be removed. Although it doesn't appear particularly interesting from the outside, it's actually the oldest timber-framed building in the town, dating from the mid-1300s. The rear wing had become very overgrown with ivy, which was beginning to invade the roof structure, and engagement with the owner persuaded him to arrange for the ivy to be killed off, carefully removed, and then for localised repairs to be made. And this part of the building is now actually up for sale for the first time in 40 years. The one building proposed to be added to the at-risk register is a Grade 2 listed redundant barn at Bacon's in Bradwell-on-Sea. Like 1 High Street, ivy growth has reached the point where it threatens to become a problem. That, in combination with several substantial areas of missing weatherboarding, mean the building's not satisfactorily weathertight. And again, this may look like just another barn, but it's actually one of our oldest barns, probably built in the late 1500s, so it's quite important. And you can see from the photograph that the ivy's sort of invading the structure, and it seems that intervention now could prevent rapid deterioration of this important structure in the near future. Eastcroft Cottage in Purley is a Grade 2 listed house that was added to the register last year. A lot of people probably recognise it. It was built in 1799 on a slip of roadside waste, hence it's so close to the road, which is quite a busy road now. The building became derelict in 2013, and a new owner submitted a proposal initially to demolish and reconstruct it in a position set back from the road, and he employed a structural engineer who claimed that it was beyond economic repair, which we didn't agree with. Needless to say, we resisted that proposal, and then over the next couple of years nothing happened and the building began to rapidly deteriorate. So windows were smashed, sections of guttering began to fall from the building, and holes began to appear in the roof. Initially, various attempts to engage with the owner were unsuccessful, and we actually reached the point of surveying the building in preparation for an urgent works notice when we were able to sort of turn things around, and the owner eventually agreed to make some necessary repairs. And within the last year, working closely with the builders, the structure has been re-roofed, and guttering has been reinstated and timber frame repairs have been made, and the repairs are in fact much more comprehensive than we could have achieved through an urgent works notice, so it's much better that we were able to actually work with the owner in the end. This is a photograph of the interior before the works, showing an exposed part of the timber frame structure, which those studs were just sitting on nothing, just a little bit of concrete. And so one of the main urgent repairs was the installation of a proper sole plate raised on a brick plinth where it wouldn't be susceptible to damp. The important original front lead glazed windows have been temporarily removed and conserved off-site, and the owner has been granted permission for a rear extension, and the final phase of the refurbishment is due to commence imminently, at which point the front windows will be reinstated and then we'll be in a position to finally remove the building from the register. Some considerable progress has been made within the last year on repairing the Grade 2 star listed buildings at Stowmarie's Great War Aerodrome. The buildings which have received the most attention are all at the southern end of the site, which is an area which is not open to the public because the buildings, it's not very safe. And so on the left, you've got the officers' mess, and then you've got that row of three buildings. They were the officers' accommodation blocks. And then in the right foreground, the NCO accommodation block. Those are the buildings which have received a lot of attention over the past year. And also permission has been granted to carry out repair work to the women's hostel building in the right-hand side in the distance, which hasn't started yet, but will start any time soon. The work to the buildings has been supported by grant assistance from Historic England, LEADER and REN, and the officers' accommodation blocks are currently part of a bid for heritage lottery funding. And the site, as you may know, also benefits from a heritage partnership agreement between this council, the trust and Historic England, which grants automatic consent for certain types of work, the idea being to reduce the degree of bureaucracy and streamline the process. So yes, the officers' mess is the largest and arguably most important building on the site, and these three photographs illustrate the dramatic changes which the building has experienced. The top one shows the mess shortly after being built with its little veranda. The middle one shows the large openings that were punched through the wall by the farmer during its when it was adapted for agricultural use. And the bottom one was taken last month, and it shows that the building has been re-roofed. So we've used corrugated corrugated cement fibre sheets, which replicate the appearance of the original asbestos sheets, which were all leaking quite badly. The original window openings have been reinstated, and those big holes have been blocked up. So that exposed brickwork will be rendered in a lime render mixed with a charcoal dust, which means that it very closely matches the original render. And very interestingly, research carried out this year has established the original paint scheme of this and other buildings on the site, and the internal decoration of the officers' mess was surprisingly vibrant, with these bright blues and reds and yellows and browns sort of reflecting the different functions of the rooms and the hierarchy of the building. It really has been quite fascinating. One of the particularly interesting discoveries is that the external joinery and rainwater goods were painted a much darker shade of green than we initially thought. So those buildings which have already been refurbished have a sort of a lighter shade of green, which is not actually correct. But from now on, we're going to be using they'll be using the correct colour. This is a photo of the non-commissioned officers' accommodation block before refurbishment. It was an extremely poor condition, but it's now been stabilised by the introduction of a reinforced concrete floor and internal steel supports. It's a recent photograph. Note the original dark green colour that's been used on the barge boards and guttering. They've recently found a forge that can make replicas of the steel windows, and they are due to go in any time now. And permission has been granted for this building to be put to use as an office. And then the three accommodation blocks are in a similar process of stabilisation work. The western two blocks, so the two nearest us in that photograph, have been fairly straightforward because they have no internal partitions. We've been able to put in reinforced structural floors and steelwork with no problem. But the western block, that one in the distance, the eastern block in the distance, which is in the worst condition, is complicated by the need to avoid the disturbance of original partitions, some of which have been found to retain important historic paint schemes, which you can sort of see a bit of in that photograph with the blue at the bottom and a sort of off-white colour above, separated by a fictive dado painted in green. So the engineers and architects have all been putting their heads together to try and find a way to stabilise what is an extremely unstable building without essentially rebuilding the internal partitions. And within the past week, they seem to have arrived at a scheme of repair that satisfies everybody. The four-mile-long wall at Great Braxted, grade two listed, is halfway through its scheme of repair. The repair work, as you know, is being funded by enabling development in the form of a housing scheme, which was permitted on the edge of Great Braxted. And roughly half of the wall has been repaired at that part, the sort of south and west of the park, and the rest is on schedule to be complete by 2021. The Victorian Peculiar People's Chapel in Tillingham, not statutory listed, but it's on our local, our register of local heritage assets, and it's in the conservation area. For those of you who don't know, the Peculiar People were a Christian sect established in southeast Essex, and they became infamous for their views that you shouldn't get medical advice or treatment. Anyway, it's original weatherboarded cladding is survives, and it's been covered over by that later pebble dash. But apart from that alteration, it's fairly well preserved. Planning permissions were granted in 2010 and 2015 to convert the chapel to a house, because it's been redundant for a long time, but those haven't been implemented. And the building is becoming increasingly dilapidated. Some of the windows have been smashed, and the site had been getting very overgrown. But we have been in correspondence with the owner, and he has recently cleared a lot of the vegetation from the site, and he tells us that he's instructed a builder who will undertake some immediate repairs pending the implementation of the conversion. Homestead in Langford is a building with which many of you will be familiar. It's a Grade 2 listed building, although looking at it in that photograph, you'd be forgiven for wondering why, perhaps. It's a very run-down appearance with modern and extremely rotten windows. But in fact, we discovered that the building incorporates the remains of a tiny medieval house, which originally would have looked like this, and it's been simply enveloped by later additions, but that makes it the oldest surviving dwelling in the centre of the village, and therefore, you know, very important. And old photographs show that the house did have nice early 18th century lead glazed windows. And with the encouragement of officers, the occupant obtained permission in 2016 to renovate the building and reinstate windows similar in style to those illustrated in the photographs. However, nothing has been done since then besides a coat of paint on the front elevation, and there's a horrible mineral felt roof repair on part of it, which was meant to be temporary, but it's now been in place for 3 years and is beginning to fail. So all interested parties have now been written to by the council's enforcement team, and if there's no further action very soon, then we've drafted we're prepared to take using a section 215 notice, which would require the implementation of approved repair work. So hopefully we will soon see some improvement to this long neglected building. And then finally, there have been some positive steps towards making essential repairs at Creeksea Place in Burnham on Crouch. This Grade 2 star listed building incorporates the remains of an Elizabethan brick mansion built for the Harris family. And part of the building is used as a wedding venue, but the oldest part, which is that tallest bit in the centre of that the L-shaped complex, remains largely empty and uninhabitable. So that bit, the central bit, dates from the 16th century. The right-hand lower wing is a combination of 16th and 20th century parts, and that bit to the left is entirely 20th century. The building has been on the at-risk register for 25 years, and it retains numerous important architectural features in the redundant parts, such as carved joinery and the original stairs. And there are structural shores propping parts of the decayed roof and the floor structures. Note in this photograph the remarkable 16th century panelling that survives in this room, which is in places sadly literally falling off the walls. But a grant application is currently being considered by Historic England to fund the repairs, which would enable those structural supports to be finally removed and essential repairs to be made. And it looks very likely that that grant will be given. And then the intention is that the work will be carried out in 2019, which would be a really important step forward for this building that's been on the at-risk register for a quarter of a century. So that is an update of the main areas of progress which have been made this year. And all going to plan, this time next year, several of the buildings will be able to be removed. And maybe even some of them will be candidates for the prestigious Malden Conservation and Design Awards. But I hope you feel
thank you very much. Well, thank you very much, Tim. That's very interesting. A lot of work, because Essex used to do this, didn't they? And then we took a decision that the work be done here, and you have done an admirable job. Any questions for Tim, please? Because he did have to obviously couldn't deliver on the whole lot, because it's quite an extensive document. But Councillor Savage.
Thank you, Chairman. My query to the officer for you is page 25 of Appendix 1 or page 41.
Oh, that's helpful, thank you.
And my question is, do you think the owner of this should be setting a good example of repair?
Sorry, I lost track of which building I
was page 25.
Appendix 1, page 25.
Yeah.
Yes.
Timber trestle at Wickham Place. Bridge, sorry, Timber trestle, viaduct, yeah. Rather, it says here.
Did you get the question?
Yes.
Right. I look forward to your answer.
It's owned by Essex County Council, and they spent a lot of money repairing this structure in the 1990s, and it seems that the decay which has occurred has actually occurred around the timbers that they put in at that time. So there seems to be an issue with the timbers they've used, perhaps, but I have made attempts to get in contact with the relevant officers.
Thank you.
Well,
is that a supplementary?
May I, Chairman, suggest that it is chased up? I know you're a county councillor, but perhaps not by yourself, but if the county council are going to get very bad for something, I don't think it's a good example to the rest of the district, is it, really?
I suppose we've got to realise why what Mr House has just said has happened, and if you think there's an issue, I can't answer that, but I'm sure Mr. Howson, as he said, is in contact and could make further inquiries.
Well, I've struggled to get in contact with anybody, really. I've made lots of attempts and offered to meet on site, but
it sounds like something then perhaps the director could take up.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay, Councillor Durham.
Thank you, Chairman. Regarding the property in Langford, which I have great sympathy with, because this has been on the radar for a very long time. But I recall that we have been fed a stream of excuses by the owners, don't we, in that the ownership or there was some probate issues, etc., etc. They seem to be relying on smoke and mirrors to avoid doing any work. I'm just wondering whether we managed to bottom out that situation and pin whoever the owner is or whoever is ultimately responsible for it to get that done, because as you say, you know, it's not helped by being literally right on the roadside within about 6 inches of the edge of the carriageway, but you know, it's not a great property to have on the entrance to the town. It looks really, really awful. So I'm just wondering whether we've managed to bottom out to carrying the can for this.
Yes, so there are disputes over the ownership of it, but we now understand who all the claimants are, and so they have all been written to.
Thank you. Any more questions, members? No? Right, okay. Then, members, there's a recommendation that this committee approves the Malden District Heritage at Risk Register 2018 for publication. Great. Can we agree that recommendation? Mr. Helsing, I thank you very much for coming to the committee and making that presentation. And I know there's been a tremendous amount of work put into that, and you're very welcome to stay for the rest of the meeting. However, if you want to go, and I suspect you may, please do so. Okay, thank you very much indeed. So, members, we now move on to the next item on the agenda, which is agenda item number 7, and it's the 2019-20 revenue budget fees and charges. And the aim of this is for the committee to consider the revenue growth fees and charges policy proposals that have been put forward by officers prior to, obviously, the approval of the budget for the next financial year. And, as you know, we're starting from a zero-based budget position, And this committee, if you could note the contents of the report, but equally you'll see the recommendation to Finance and Corporate Services Committee. And really we're interested in looking at the policy areas, and then Finance and Corporate Services, as in Little 2 and Little 3, have their job to do there. You see on the appendices, you've got three appendices. There's the area of growth on Appendix 1. You've got Appendix 2, which defines the policy situation and proposed policy for 2019-20. And then you'll see, last but not least, the letter from PHE, Public Health England, regarding shellfish testing, and which is applicable to the growth area, where you'll see that they're trying to get full cost recovery for the service, because they do not receive central area funding. Mr. Dobson, do you want to say anything on the report, please?
Thank you, Chairman. I think you've said most of it. But, as the Chairman said, that this is for the contents of the report to be noted. It will then go to Finance and Corporate Services, and ultimately, if approved, then make up part of the medium-term financial strategy that will go to Council. The main issues are the proposed increase to revenue budget for the charge for shellfish testing of £4,000, which is fees that the Council pays to Public Health England, who have to do the testing on those. And the other proposed policy chargings, one is to moorings to remove the alignment of charges with sailing clubs to allow a more market-based charging to enable the Council to maximise the commercial income from the moorings. And similarly, a change to the wharfage charges. Currently, there's a 50% discount to the day rate if those are taken out quarterly. And the proposal is to remove that discount and to look at the only discount being the 5% discount if there's an annual wharfage that's taken out. So again, increasing the commercial income for the council by having more market-based charging to what we do. Thank you.
Any questions? Councillor Savage, and then Councillor St. Joseph.
I have a question. It's on page 44, under 3.4.2, fees and charges. It's the last sentence. The charitable trust discount would be removed. I actually wonder whether that is good PR, since it might be said that the money saved by putting up the charitable trust has been sent to a private company to provide broadband. And we've got an election coming up next year.
No. Can anyone answer that? It's the last sentence. The charitable trust discount would be removed. That's what's being recommended in the policy, as Mr. Dobson just explained. Well, about the changes, I think that's what Councillor Savage is referring to. It's all to do with the river wharfage and the discount. Have you got a response to Councillor Savage at all, anyone, or you can look into that?
We can look into that.
Thank you. Councillor St. Joseph was next, and then Councillor Fluker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Two questions. The plan is to not have the moorings aligned with local clubs. Given that the clubs are acting as an unpaid conduit to pay some of the mooring fees, I wondered how that arrangement is going to continue. Or is there going to be a separate body collecting the fees for individual moorings? And also on the second item in the table on Appendix 2, the river wharfage, has consideration been given to the effect this might have, if indeed any, on the number of Thames barges moored at Hythe Quay, which are an obvious tourist attraction?
Mr. Dodson?
In terms of the...
Thank you, Chairman. In terms of collection of the fees, it's something I'll have to go away and check. In terms of the effect, I don't know the overall
effect individually on barges, but the wharfage and moorings, based on the analysis that's been done, it would realise an additional 20,000 income. So I'd have to look into exactly how that's been done. Obviously, we'd have to see what sort of effect those are having, whether that's based on everybody staying put or whether there's a elasticity to those charges that has been calculated that some of those wouldn't be there. So again, I'd have to look into that.
I take it then, Mr. Dodson, that information would be furnished to Finance and Corporate Services from this committee, because
absolutely,
we were being asked to note, and yet they've obviously going to we're recommending to them various things. So I think it would be useful to have those points clarified and also Finance aware. Sorry, Councillor St. Joseph, is this a supplementary or another question?
Supplementary.
Okay.
I mean, I just want to reiterate my concerns, because if we were to lose those barges to another port where, for example, there might well be more access to sailing, because they're pretty tide restricted there, it would have a wider impact.
Okay, thank you. What was the question in the supplementary question?
The question was to make sure that particular point was examined.
Yeah, and as I said, Mr. Dobson, you'll make sure this does get furnished to Finance, please.
Yeah.
This Mr. Councillor Fuca. And Councillor Fuca's next, and then Councillor Beale.
No,
we didn't.
Right. Chairman, I wondered, under 3.4.2, whether it would be sensible if we treated the charitable trust discount in the same way as we're treating the Pond Park. Although I think it's worth noting that although the barge companies are all run as businesses, they are also charitable trusts as well, Chairman.
Mm.
So it's a difficult one, but I believe that the fees for charities using the ponds are actually agreed by, full council agreed that they would be agreed by the Director of Service Delivery, I presume in conjunction with my friend, the chairman of the Community Services Committee.
Oh,
no.
So, well, it'll be my other friend, the chairman of planning and licensing.
Yeah.
But I think that's, I think that's perhaps where we should go with that one. And as far as the moorings are concerned, if it helps Councillor St. Joseph, I think what's actually happening is, in some instances, the council is renting moorings to yacht clubs who are then renting them for 400-500% profit. So I think it's time we had a little bit of a profit share that actually reflected the needs of the landlords and our shortfall of money at the moment.
Right, thank you. Councillor Beale.
Thank you. Taking consideration what the leader has just said, is it possible to say that they can't, these are leases and they're out? No, we can have a secondary lease arrangement.
No subletting.
Yeah, I think that'd be possible.
Chairman, could I come back?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
I think it then goes back to impact on what Councillor St. Joseph said, because the reason why we have the subletting is because they become effectively our agent to get their hands dirty with black water mud and collect all the money as well. So I think in that particular instance it's the right thing to do. So otherwise we would be collecting all the mooring fees ourselves, and I suspect that we wouldn't get any return on them.
Right, members. Well, when I'm Councillor Savage, is this a separate question, please? I'll let you come up. I'm just
it's a supplementary, really.
To what?
To what I said earlier.
Right.
But,
or asked earlier.
Yes.
Thank you.
Councillor Fluker has actually stolen some of my words. I wonder if he's been plagiarised my notes. But I would like to say barges are not all the charities down there. The Brent Tug is, for example,
yes, there is.
And there are. It goes a little bit wider than just barges.
Right. Well, members, I'm in your hands. We've got to here for us, the committee, to say note the report. I'm hearing some concerns, and then there's a recommendation to Finance and Corporate Services Committee, Little 2 and Little 3. Councillor Fluker, you seem to indicate you'd like to see perhaps some consideration regarding the charitable trust.
Well, Chairman, if it helps, I mean, I would propose that we deal with the... we'd make a recommendation, if that's the way it works. This committee could agree to make a recommendation to Finance and Corporate Services Committee that the director reports back specifically around that point. And I think the other points that have been raised, and I think with that, Chairman, I think the subject to that, I think that we can
agree
2-1 and move on.
So are we happy with that, that we agree the recs, but we'll have tapped on the end there, subject to the director answering, pointing out the points that this committee has concerns on to Finance and Corporate Services. Do we agree, members? Thank you very much indeed. Moving on then, we'll move on to the meaty subject, well, quite meaty, if you read it. It's a large document. It's the Green Infrastructure Strategy Supplementary Planning Document, stakeholder and public, and that's where my lines disappear on my computer, consultation for some reason. Perhaps I need to scroll down, but it looks as though it finishes there and doesn't have another line. I think, Mr. Butt, you're going to take us through this. I must admit, I've combed through, I've got a few points to make at the end of it, but I'm sure other members will. And this is something, members, I think you'll realise we did have a survey done and study at one time, but this is a continuation of that, and this will be something that would be a material planning consideration. We have the powers to go out to consultation, but then, of course, anything that's come back and considered would have to be from us then a recommendation to council for adoption. But Mr. Butt, I'll leave you to take us through it, because I know you've done extensive work on this and your team have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairman. As has been pointed out, this is a consultation draft on the Green Infrastructure Strategy, and the intention is that the Green Infrastructure Strategy is adopted as supplementary planning guidance, supplementary planning document, and it will be subject to a consultation period later this year and into early 2019. It's a follow-on from the 2011 Green Infrastructure Study, which formed an integral part of our evidence base for the LDP, and it comes in two parts. The first part, which is set out in Appendix 1, which is the bigger of the two documents, is the strategy itself, and that sets out the main themes of the strategy, the action plan, and also the technical analysis, which includes a report on the various workshops that were held in the spring, which helped inform the overall strategy in the direction that it's taken. The second appendix in the report is the proposed green infrastructure projects. It's a shorter document, and that sets out a series of thematic or area-based projects which have come out of the stakeholder and member engagement workshops held in the spring. At this stage, it's important to point out that these are not fully developed projects. They will need to be subject to a full business case and working very closely with partners to ensure that they are deliverable, that there is a robust business case in place, and also assessments of the full life cycle costs have been taken into account on that, so there isn't any default position back to the council, and the council has to take on long-term liabilities. The importance of all of this is not only in terms of providing supplementary planning advice and guidance to the LDP, but also helping inform neighbourhood plans, helping to inform reviews of the infrastructure delivery plan in the future, helping to inform Section 106 agreements in place. If we have this in place, we can link in any developments that may affect one of these areas can then be brought in. We can then link this into a Section 106 agreement, for example. The recommendation is to approve a public consultation, and then once that public consultation is concluded and an assessment of the responses has been made, a report will be brought back to this committee. Thank you.
And just to say, because we are aware, the public consultation would actually, should the committee agree, happen over the Christmas period, that you have to have a six-week public consultation, but because of that, it would be a longer consultation of 7 weeks. I think I'm right on that, aren't I, Mr. Butt?
It would be a minimum of 7 weeks.
Yes, minimum of 7 weeks. Any questions, please, or any points to raise? Well, actually, I've got a couple of points. I did say before, but I said any questions, and then I did start by saying, well, okay, I'll do it after the meeting, then I'll do it as a part of the consultation. But there are some interesting points there. Yeah. Well, I'll raise it quickly. Actually, the proofreading. There's a bit missing, which doesn't make sense in a certain area. The maps, quite frankly, I found the colours, maybe it's my eyes, but I found some of the colours so close together, hard to differentiate when you look at the key to place where the keys were, especially the red colours and the darker red. And there's, it's Cock Clarks is Cox Clark, I think. You need to check the name. I know that's a regular mistake. And then also there was some comments on about us and not much mental health problems, etc., under 2.71. If you speak to Ben Page, I think you find that mental health is an issue in the district with children. There's concerns there, and obesity and things like that. But I can send you that further detail. Right, members, so we agree that it's got consultation. And if, you, and if you've got any points you want to raise, you can actually send them in to Mr. Butt. As well. Now we move on to another area which members may recall. We've had several reports on this, Brownfield Land Register, and this now is seeking from us that the Brownfield Land Register Part 1, for us to approve it, and then there would have to be a recommendation to Council to go on the Council's website for publication. We've had a similar sort of activity before, but Mr. Butt, you'd probably just like to explain these findings for part the two parts. We had part one consideration some while ago, didn't we? And something went on the website. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. This is a statutory responsibility of the Council and all local authorities in England and Wales to produce a Brownfield Register. There are two parts to the register. Part one is a list of Brownfield sites that are considered suitable for residential development. And part two is a list of sites from that first list, which the council is council would be minded to grant planning permission in principle. However, the six sites that have been identified within the district, which are outlined in Appendix 1 to the report, five of those already have planning permission. Therefore, there is no need to grant it permission in principle. And the sixth one is allocated in the LDP, and again, there's no need to grant it. And it wouldn't be suitable anyway because it's a brownfield portion of a larger site which should be delivered comprehensively. So the recommendation is to approve the Part 1 register and refer that to full council. It has to be a decision of full council and refer that to full council for similarly
members,
for approval.
Any questions? Right, Councillor Beale and then Councillor Savage.
It's very strange that a lot of mushroom farms in our district aren't classified as brownfield sites. Because they've applied for planning permission, etc., then been indicated, oh no, they're not a brownfield site. I think that needs defining what is going to be a brownfield site and what isn't, because it's very, very confusing to know exactly which ones are acceptable.
The definition of brownfield land excludes any buildings that are in agricultural use. For the purpose of a redundant farm, has an agricultural purpose, and therefore it's not deemed as. So we've followed that definition.
Thank you. I've never seen this written up as a header to start off, and people start talking about it, but it's interesting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councillor Savage, I saw your hand up.
Thank you, Chairman. Appendix 1, page 61. It's the very top one, Sads Wall Station Road, Malden. It's a planning application in 2011, and the comment is planning permission started for delivery of the access road. Well, it's an eyesore. Nothing's happened. They've just put this bit of road in, and it's just totally overgrown. Even the shuttering around it has started to fall down. So I don't know whether
that.
We could have an update, or is this not the correct committee to raise this?
I can't answer that. Sounds like a planning thing to me, more so, but I don't know if you have any intelligence on it.
In terms of the actual site itself, there have been some discussions recently with the landowner about bringing the site forward, and it's a key site as part of the central area master plan as well. Mm. For the purposes of this report, the site... it's been classified that the permission has been implemented, therefore it sits on the report as part of part one. But in terms of the discussions about bringing the site forward, there are discussions taking place and have been taking place with the landowner, and it is an important site for us.
Yes.
So that's development control more, isn't it? Be involved in that? Yes. Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Butt? Well, members, then, can we agree the recommendation as on the order paper?
Agreed.
Thank you very much indeed. We're now moving on, and we come to agenda item number 10. Any other items of business that the chairman of the committee decides are urgent? I have none, so you'll be pleased to hear that. And agenda item number 11 now. Can I move exclusion of the public and press to resolve that under section 100A bracket 4 of the Local Government Act 1972, the public be excluded from the meeting for the following items of business on the grounds that they involve the likely disclosure of exempt information as defined in paragraph 4 of part 1 of schedule 12A to the Act, and that this satisfies the public interest. And those items are agenda item number 12, section 106 agreement, six-monthly update, and agenda item number 13, tender exercise for licensing services from 1st of April 2019. Is that, can that be seconded, please? Thank you, Councillor Savage. And can it be agreed, members?
Agreed.
Thank you very much.